two 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break. And our main speaker will be speaking for 30 minutes. The first 10-minute speaker is Daniel.
Hello, everyone. I'm Daniel. I'm an alcoholic. And grateful to be here. My friend, my childhood friend, called me last night, and he started off with a joke. And he started crying. But he can't stop drinking and drugging. And I've been there before. I've been there before, and it really brought me back. I was able to, it's amazing how this program works, so I was able to reach out to a few people, and if my friend wants to go to treatment, that can be set up. And if he wants to go to a meeting in D.C., that's also set up. And I spoke to him this morning, going, I understand about this program and how it can change your life, but I can't do that, so that's all there for him. I came to these rooms in 2012. First meeting was a Thursday night upstairs. I had 2 days, and I stayed sober for a year and a half, and I started feeling good, got all the externals, job I've always wanted, and then took my foot off the gas. And, as Michael says, little by slowly, I stopped calling my sponsor, stopped fellowshipping, stopped making my calls, stopped going to meetings, and then I was at a company event. And it was open bar. And the breakfast bar was just talking to me. It was really my alcoholism. I'm like, dude, it may be fine. You have a year and a half, you have everything you want. Family's back. You shouldn't drink. So I'm now having this internal dialogue. I was like, no, I can't. I'm an alcoholic. How are you with you? They won, and I had that drink. And I had another one, and I had another one. But before I went home, I had one more. And I woke up tomorrow. And then the next morning, I'm in the office, and my friend Chris is not here, so now I'm comfortable. And I'm in the office, and I'm like, oh wow, maybe I am cured, because that happened last night. And I was not cured. I picked up right where I left off. Within 3 months, I was pulling all nighters, purposely waking up at 10 a.m. so that's when the liquor store opens, so I can get a couple of airplane bottles on my way to work. 74th and 2nd, then two more on 69th and 2nd, and then two more on 16th, 3rd, and 3rd. And next. By that time, I was already really drunk, so I pretended to work, and then I went to lunch and had two more airplane bottles, and I was just too drunk to go back to work, so I went home and I passed out. And I wanted desperately to get back into the rooms to be sober, and I put days together. I had 60, I had 5, I had 30, I had 90, I had 20, 5 months, 6 months. And this went on for 4 years, 4.5 years. And there were times when I drank right before the meeting, during the meeting, after the meeting. And I wanted so desperately to like be sober. And it's like, just because I wanted to be sober, it did not mean I got the program. And one night, it was an all-nighter, like all-nighters. It was 6 a.m. in my bed with the birds outside. And either I'm getting like real help or I throw myself in front of the bus, because it's just where I got to. So I text my brother, I text him, my friends, and, you know, team effort, and they all set out for me to go to rehab, and I went, and then took suggestions and went to sober living. And, you know, there's a line in the big book that says, rarely have we seen anyone fell through the door like that. But the big book doesn't say go to sober living, it just says, like, do take the suggestions and do them, and do what's outlined in the book. So I did that this time around, and it's been working. I have two years. On Thursday, I'll be picking up my taxes. From my account for years 15, 16, 17, 18. When I first got back from sober living, I used to go to the 7 Street workshop, and I lived between first and second. And I couldn't walk down first, second, or third, because I owed every bar and people money. So I used to go to Lexington to go out and get some in New York. I managed to pay everyone every bar off. I can walk anywhere in the city now. I saw some green on events. I understand why. I'm comfortable in my skin today. I wasn't nervous all day. Like, just like, oh, just right. But it never really came. And that's incredible, because I would be nervous about, like, everything. How do I look? I gotta say this, I gotta do that, I gotta do that. It's not like anymore. And this time around, I've also done a lot more service. And that keeps you busy. If you do the literature commitment at your workshop, it keeps you really busy. And I try to join a meeting, and I just really wasn't the only thing I've done this year, was just say yes. I've said yes to everything. And it's like, yes. Yes! Yes!
Yeah. always ending in tragedy. Divorce, death, you name it. Very, not normal, but that's what it was like for me. And I did it for a very long time. And I grew up in a home where there was an alcoholic who eventually got sober in this program. And thank God. So I sort of had this aversion to the whole idea of ever drinking because I didn't want to be like that person. But, you know, my mind got the best of me when I was 18 years old and I picked up a drink. And I can, to this day, it was that was just like a life-changing event for me. I finally felt like I didn't understand that. And I felt right with the world. And I wanted to do it again. But, you know, to be honest, like, you know, I went on drinking until I was age 39, and I had long periods of being very, very dry. You know, I was hospitalized for, you know, depression. But I know now that it was just untreated alcoholism. I told you how many hours I would spend just staring at my ceiling and what am I going to do with my life? You know, how am I going to feel better? How am I going to change? And then in the back of my mind, I was like, well, if I just drank, that's going to make me feel better. But I can't do that because I don't want to be like the people in my family that were active. But, you know, that just doesn't work. And I'm just going to speed up, and she's like, you're okay. And I'm like, where's my quietness? I appreciate it. Appreciate the service. that's what keeps me coming here. So what happened? I'm going to get sober for the first time. So what happened was, I was seeing three therapists, taking medications for anxiety, thinking I was going to die every day, which I pretty much felt since the age of 15 when I had my first panic attack. And so I was seeing three therapists, and I kept saying to them, Michael, is there a pill I can take that's going to make me feel like when I'm drinking, because it's the only time I feel okay? And they're like, no. But none of them thought I drank enough to, you know, to make a suggestion to do something, you know, different. And then I very, very quickly, physically couldn't stop drinking, and I called a friend who had made amends to me about 6 months before that, Mike W., who used to be a member of this group. And he said, you know, try not to drink for a week. And I laughed at him. So I tried, I think I lasted like 3.5 days. And my brother, who was probably a year sober at the time, he also said, you know, try not to drink for a week. And so I lasted 3.5 days. I called Mike bawling, and I'm not a big crier. And I'm like, dude, I can't stop. And he's like, well, come to this meeting with me. So he knew to take me to the balcony upstairs. And so we went there, and that night, you know, Bob was, I think, the chair of the meeting, and had a friend, Barbara, speak, and I, for the first time in my life, I'm like, this woman feels and speaks exactly how I've been feeling all my life. I'm like, that's crazy. Like, that's nuts. And I'm like, but I still, like, well, I didn't drink as much as, you know, this person in my family, so I can't be an alcoholic, and, you know, Mike drank more than me, and, like, you know, but whatever Barbara said, you know, and I still have her tape, and I do listen to it on occasion. You know, I'm like, okay, well, maybe I'll try this again. So I think for the next 60 days, I came here and I said I desire to stop drinking until Jeff Rossman said, I'm sorry, Jeff R. said, said, you know, someone you're going to talk about alcoholic. And so I was like, all right, I'll give it to peer pressure. I got a sponsor, started going through the steps. And I had a real issue with the whole idea of having a God. There was an atheist. And that contempt prior investigation is eventually what took me out. I went out 3.5 years later. After things did get good for a while, I'm not going to deny that. But I went out. I couldn't bring myself to turn my life, my will over to something greater than myself. I wanted to still run the show. And so I went out with something else. I had an awful experience and led me to a drink. And it was so, in my mind, just so terrible. And I picked up a drink. I wanted another drink. And the next morning, after this horrible experience, I'm like, I want to drink again. So I think I would, at that point, I was like, all right, I'm convinced. There's something, I have alcoholism. But I wasn't sure I wanted to come back. I was embarrassed. I didn't want to raise my hand. All my friends that I came in with, and, the people I work, I have a sponsee. And then a good friend of mine, program Mariah, she said she wanted to talk, to my sponsor, Tika. And so I did, and I don't know if she said it to me that night. She's like, can you believe that I believe? And I could. I was desperate because I knew that I was just like, keep on doing it, I'd probably die or just end up in another hospital. So I just, I started working with Tika, and I don't do this right, I don't do this perfectly, but I believe that she believes in this day, I still do, I've seen these people change in this time, seeing people that couldn't look me in the eye, well, I can't really look you guys in the eye right now, but, that, the light goes on, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world, and I never thought I was going to, I never thought I was going to change. I thought I was going to just be miserable, I really, truly, honestly do, and I have people that challenge me in my life today, and I know that there's hope for them. You don't have to be the condition. There's a way out in this program, and I'm entirely grateful for it. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Peter. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Peter. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Peter.
And I was thinking on the other sheet, which is going, man, I should really get the mention, but, when I grew up, I was one of nine kids, and I was a twin. And sort of was normal to be in a large family. Thought it was normal that my dad drank. He was a New York City firefighter working in Manhattan. And between my dad and all my uncles, they were heavy drinkers. And it was just a part of growing up. These big family functions, whether it's, with my kids, you had a lot of baptisms, communion, all these different things. And it was always held in the house or someone else's house, and large cousins, big groups of people. And there was always booze being served, and it seemed like fun. And I remember, when we were little kids, especially during the summer, my dad would get a keg of birch beer. And what we would do is, go around and sort of clean up, put the beer in our birch beer, and sort of mix it together. That's all the story. But, being a twin, and I was number six, he was number seven, I have a lot of older brothers. And there's two girls in the family. The second one was my sister. And my older brothers and sisters were in charge of watching us. So I thought it was normal. You know, I didn't realize until either, like being a parent, and I had the opportunity to thank my sister. Like, she would have to take us to the park, she would have to give us a bath. She was a full-time caregiver, you know, just like in high school. And I never realized it until later when I was a parent. And I had the opportunity to make an amends with her. You know, how important of a role she played in my life. She was a goody-two-shoes, and she didn't drink. But now, right below her, that's when the drinkers started. And the way it would work is, if my brothers were going out, and you know, the rule was, when the street lights came on, they had to come in the house. You know, you could do whatever you wanted all day long. When the street lights came on, it's time to come in the house. But when we started going out, it would be like, my brother would be like, "Oh, Dad, there's the high school basketball game." And we would wind up drinking behind the gym of the high school basketball game. You know, and basically his theory was, if you're with us and you drink some of this, then you're going to be a part of it. You can't rat us out, right? So it's like, I don't know if people remember, like, Bourne's Farm, the strawberry wine, and all that stuff, you know? So if he was a freshman in high school, like, he had to be 6th, 7th, 8th grade, drinking already. I can remember being in the 6th grade and looking forward to trying to get to the St. Patrick's Day parade. And I was going to take the bus to the ferry with my buddies, and we were going to go to the parade. And like, we were so drunk that we made it like 3 stops on the bus and had to go off because we were getting sick. And like, you think about it, in the context of, like, what does that have to do with being an alcoholic? I started very young. And with the drinking, I never had an on-off switch. I was always drinking and getting drunk and throwing up and doing this and that. And, you know, you don't realize it until later. Like, today I'm a parent, and my daughter is in recovery. So April of last year, she had a year. And in watching her in high school and seeing her drink and seeing the consequences made me think back when I was trying to relate to her. And I was trying to say, "Carrie, you know, I was smart, but I just did enough to get by. I was on the track team, and I was really good. And then I stopped. Why did I stop? Because I was drinking. It got in the way of my drinking." Like, I can remember we ran in Van Cortlandt Park, and on the way home, we would get someone to go into the bodega and get us beer to drink on the train, to go back to the ferry, to go back to Staten Island. And this is a bunch of Catholic school kids that are on the track team, and you're supposed to be an athlete, right? And you think about that. Like, normal people do not do that stuff when they're, whether in high school. So by the time I was a sophomore, my brother and I were asked to leave that high school because of our drinking, along with 4 or 5 other boys that were just trouble. And when I came into AA, people were saying, you know, "Well, what did you lose because of your drinking?" And I'm like, "Well, I didn't lose anything." You know, like, I had a job, I never lost a job. I had a wife, I didn't lose her yet. I had 2 kids. I had a house, I had 2 cars. The DWI in Manhattan was just a mistake. Like, who drives in Manhattan? And you, when you live in Manhattan, you only need a driver's license, right? So they take it away for 6 months, and it's like, no, who cares? It's like, they don't need one. It's not like you live where I live now, where you need a car to get around. So what I'm saying is, in trying to relate this to my daughter, like, what I lost because of drinking. Like, I was in the Boy Scouts, and I really enjoyed it. I did everything to become an Eagle Scout. You know, like, true alcoholism, like, I was obsessed with getting merit badges, right? I had everything. You know, I'm Irish Catholic from Staten Island, and we went to a Boy Scout camp called Ten Mile River Camp Cornetop. and it was an Orthodox Jewish camp. And my scout leader was like, we're going to go there because they got better food. So I made friends with the scout Jew from Long Island that was going to Fomont, because when I saw that movie about Fomont, I was going to go there. So me and my buddy convinced this Jewish scoutmaster of all Orthodox Jewish kids to take us, Catholic kids, with them cross country for 30 days. And you know what? We went, right? But now you think about it, like, at that level, it's alcoholism. It's like you see something, you want it, you're going to get it no matter what it takes. And we did it. But right when I was about to get to the rainbow, to get the eagle, what did I do? I didn't do anything. I had to do one more thing, submit one final piece of paper. But drinking got in the way. And I articulate that now because in trying to help my daughter through this process of watching her, I had to send her away at 15 years old. And the hardest thing I ever had to do in my life, I had to hire strangers to come get her at 3 in the morning, take her away to a wilderness camp. But because I loved her, I was willing to do that. Because I was sober at the time, I was willing to do that. So they say, like, what are the gifts of sobriety? If I was drinking, I would not have been capable of doing that, because that took strength. It didn't take weakness, it took strength. And I realize that today. But getting back to, like, the point of it is that, like, in AA or in sobriety, we never know what's going to help us. We never know what relationship we're going to make. And with me, growing up, it was, I don't know why I drink. You know, I'm a little hyper. I get bored easy, whatever. There's 9 kids out of 9. 6 are alcoholic, 3 are not. Who knows? A bunch of us have many years without drinking. Some people just abstain. But my point is that there's no, I don't need to know the reason why I'm alcoholic, just that I am, right? And when I was 14, my mom took all 9 kids to Al-Anon. And they were getting ready to set dad up, right? So he'd been drinking too much. So we went to this Al-Anon. And we're all sitting around the table, and they're, you know, okay, we're going to throw him out. And when he came home from work, he didn't know what hit him, Mike. So we were there, and my mom was there, and she's like, your bags are packed, and you have to leave. And he said, leave where? Like, you have to leave the house. I'm like, you drink too much, and I can't do it. I have 9 kids, and you. And he looked at her, and he said, it's just the drinking? And she said, yeah. So I'll never drink again. You know, and it talks about in our literature, there are certain people who, if given sufficient reason, can quit drinking. So my dad loved his wife and his 9 kids, and he had a strong faith, and he said, I'll never drink again. And he got up and he hugged every kid. And they weren't big on hugs then, and, you know, feelings, but, you know, got some love out of it. And he said he's not going to drink anymore. And he said, you know what? I'm going to quit smoking too. Because if I drink, I want to smoke, and if I smoke, I want to drink, so that's it. Until the day he died, he never drank again. And he never smoked again. Because he loved his family. And he made a commitment to his wife. So you know, like, he did not have that mental obsession. He had the physical allergy. You know, like, he could go for a month, but then go on a 3-day bender. And some people have that. When they put the alcohol in their body, they just can't put it down. work session as well. And I'm really fortunate that I had a sponsor who educated on the disease aspect, on the allergy, on the mental obsession, right? Because it talks about, like, you know, can you pick it up or put it down? Does it make a big deal? So when I saw my dad quit drinking like that, I thought my whole life, anytime I want to quit, I could just stop, just like my father did. Pretty logical, right? And it didn't work that way. So I'm graduating high school, and my dad says, you should go to the military. And I don't think there was much money for college, but, you know, by then, you know, just out of control. Like, who's going to invest money in someone that's a daily drinker in high school? And with drinking every day, I was able to graduate on the merit roll. I transferred to public school, was in the co-op program. So I worked in Manhattan 1 week on Wall Street, and then the other week I went to school. So I did 2 weeks worth of school in 1 week while drinking on a daily basis. And it talks about that in the book, that people that drink, they can get stuff done as long as you allow them to drink, right? And teaching that. And, you know, I thought it was normal that this 15-year-old kid was drinking on the ferry on the way home. It was just normal. Like, I didn't know any better. And the people that I looked up to, and my idols, and the people that I talked to on a daily basis, they were drinking the way I was drinking. And if you weren't drinking, I wasn't talking to you. I had no reason to hang out with you. So a buddy of mine, his grandfather died, and I went to the funeral in the wake, and his job was to shine shoes at Lehman Brothers. I said, okay, I'm going to work on Wall Street, I'm going to college. Yeah, where is that? I'll go there. And the grandmother was like, yeah, you'll do it? I said, oh yeah, I'll do it. And I went there and I started shining shoes. And this was back in 1981. And did that. I was able to drink every day. I was able to drink before work. I was able to drink at lunch. I was able to drink after work. It was great. And I learned what it was like to be a stockbroker. I said, you know what? At 21, I'm going to be a broker. That's when everybody graduates high school. And they said, you had to be 21 to be licensed, even though I don't think there's an age limit. But anyway, I did that. And the only time I quit drinking was for 30 days to study for that test, because I was not going to pass. And you know, that's an alcoholic. Like, when you're determined, when you want to get something done, you can't. And it's like my daughter, when she needed to get money, she was very good at convincing me. And here, oh, I forgot, you know, I just sort of remember seeing the seed of humanity, right? A fever on alcohol. My sobriety date is June 24th, 1998. I have a group, it's called the Bedford Village Group. I have a sponsor, his name is Paul, celebrating 42 years of continuous sobriety. Which is pretty cool, right? And so getting back to where I was, it's like, I'm getting this job, I'm doing it, I'm attaining what I want. Thank you. I'm going to become a success, right? Bill talks about it in the book, like, you know, the urge to succeed is on. So I become a broker, and I start doing well, but I'm either better than you or less than you. And later on, I learned, like, egomaniac with an insecurity complex, right? And I was very good at being a broker, and I made money, and I drank every day. And then it was March or May of 1990, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at Exchange Views. And what happened is, I started dating a woman in February of 1990. And by May, you drink a lot.
Do you need before dinner drinks, after dinner drinks, during dinner drinks? You're always late to work. What's wrong with you? You know? So what I did is two of my friends that I used to drink with every day joined the luncheon club, and they were not hanging out with me anymore. I thought they joined some like exclusive luncheon club. And they were going to Exchange Views, which is a meeting downtown, and they were counting days. So they invited me, and I'm like, well, what do you got to do for membership? You know, we talk to them, and you're in. Peter, I have one day. And you know, again, I buy into the whole thing. But now I'm looking at the steps there. And I'm like, step four, nah. We don't talk about stuff outside the house. But if we ever discuss dad's drinking or, you know, a crashed car, that was back in the days when the police would escort you home. Have a drink in the kitchen. It wasn't like it is now. But I wasn't going to do all that jazz, so when they suggested I get a sponsor, and my buddy from work suggested he would be my sponsor, I was like, okay, I'll do 1, 2, 3. I'm okay with that. And then I stopped, you know? But what I did is I did 90 days in 90 days. Got a group, didn't get a sponsor, had a coffee commitment, used to set up, used to go out and speak, go to meetings at night. I loved it. But what happened is, if I had a sponsor, they would have told me, like, hey, you're new to AA, things are going to change. Make no major changes right away. So I came in May, June, I got engaged. In September, I got married. And then later on, it was the next January, it was cold out, so we moved to California. The meetings were different out there. They gave people birthday cakes, and it was like totally weird. So I'm like, I don't need to go anymore. I'm cured. You know, and I'm an avid reader, and I love to read, and the big book, I think, is an excellent piece of literature. So I read the book, even while drinking. Not highly recommended. And what happened is we moved back to New York, and I was on a business trip to Montana with my boss. And we're going to convince someone to give us $25 million to manage. And it's a beautiful day, and my boss has one. And he asked me if I want one. Now, I'm not going to AA anymore. I haven't had a spiritual awakening, so what do I do? I have one. And it's amazing because, like, in Montana, it was just, and this is a perfect metaphor for what happened with drinking, right? So it was sunny out, and we were in just a long sleeve shirt, and we were fly fishing. And by night, there was a snowstorm, and there was like a foot of snow. But we went out to dinner, and I'm driving this client back. We got him so drunk. And the boss is in the front seat, and I'm driving a Chevy Suburban in Montana, and a blackout, and a blizzard. And I have had a drink, took my first drink 12 hours ago. So, like, I picked up right where I left off. And, again, when I had the DWI in Manhattan, I'm like, I live in Manhattan, no big deal. Didn't hurt anybody. Paid fine, move on. But now I'm driving a client in my firm, and my boss, who recently passed away of this disease, did not get the solution.
by a horrific, horrific death.
And I'm in a blackout. So I come off the plane, and I'm not going to drink when I get off the plane. And my ex-wife was pregnant, and she was actually happy I was drinking. She said, "You were miserable." And then two kids, and drinking every day. And I can remember, like, the night my son was born in New York Hospital right over here. I was living in the West Village. I went home, and I drank, like, a bottle of whiskey, smoked a cigar, because I had a son. We had the opportunity to be blessed by God with his beautiful baby. Dude, I had a son. Man. And that's, like, I'm talking, that's like the, that's it right here. And the next day when I went to pick them up, like, they asked me, like, "Do you need the hospital?" Like, I'm sweating, And you think about it, yes, it's funny today, but it wasn't funny then. And for me, like, my, for that 5 years of being out there, every day with the dry heaves in the shower, sweating in February on the train, I wasn't going to drink at lunch. I was not going to drink at lunch. And I never made it. I never made it. And then one day, it was June 24th, 1998, which is my sobriety date, I had played golf and made 17 holes. Or it was actually the 23rd was when the story happened. And I rewarded myself with a drink on 18, because there was 18 holes in golf. So I did very well. I did 17 without drinking. I deserved one. And then by 8 o'clock at night, I'm in a blackout, and I couldn't walk up the stairs in my house. I had to crawl. And my son is four, my daughter's two, and my son said, "Daddy's sick," and his mother said, "No, Daddy's drunk. Come on, let's go to bed." That was it. But see, I knew from years ago, going to all those meetings, wait, there's a solution. Go back to that place. And at the time, I had a kid working with me, Mario, who was sober, who was waiting for me, who would not break his anonymity. Because we were trying to get him to go out drinking, and he wouldn't, so I knew he was, but he wouldn't admit it. And he said, "Coach, you ready to go to a meeting today?" And I said, "Yeah." And I began the process, right? Went down to Exchange Views, humbled and humiliated, 8 years later. How are we doing on time? How many?
Almost 1 minute.
1 minute. Good. Okay. And I had 1 minute. Starting already.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Five. All right, let's start again. Let's all take it. I'll do your job, I'll do mine. It's like one of these things where you gotta go down there and say that you have 1 day. And you're looking at the guy who 8 years ago, like, you blew him away, like, you weren't as bad as him. And he's up there sleeping. So I did what Mario said. He said, "You got to get home from where you live." So I joined Harbor Island. And I had to get a sponsor, and I got this guy, John, that I knew. And John told me, "You could go to all the meetings you want in the city, as long as you're at both meetings, for a home group." I was like, "But no, John, I went during lunch." I was like, "Okay. Peanut butter and jellies in the middle, word of the bread. Can't make a sandwich without it." So no matter any meeting that I went to, I still had to go to my home group. And then we sat down and we went through the process of the steps. So that fourth step that I wasn't going to do got done, and it got done quickly. And I sat with them on a park bench out in Harbor Island on the day after Thanksgiving. and I shared with this man everything. And it was a very freeing experience, the most free I had ever felt. And I had tried therapy, and I had tried confession, and I tried it all. And just one man talking to another, and me crying and crying, saying it's okay, you want to be that person. And I let everything out. You know, and right then and there, that's when the process began to start. And we went through the rest of the steps, and Daniel was talking about making amends. You know, I can walk down the street today, and if there's anybody here, I don't have to be afraid of anyone. You know, and he said something to me that I didn't understand at the time. He said, the person you were is here, and the person you're going to be is here. So anything that's happened up until this point is done. We've already talked about it. It's over. It's about what you do going forward. You know? And the sponsor was just so key, right? When I was making my events list, I didn't think I owed my in-laws an event. I was very nice to them. They loved me. But I drove their grandchildren around drunk. Because we were at a barbecue, and my wife wanted to have a couple glasses of wine, and she's not an alcoholic. And I was not going to drink. I'd be in the kitchen or over here, and I'd be drinking and saying that I wasn't. That I was fine to drive home. You don't think about that until you quit. I remember being a kid when I said, Dad, are we rich? He said, I don't know about you, but I'm the richest guy alive because I have 9 beautiful children. Right? And if you ask me about my net worth, my greatest net worth is that I was able to quit when my kids were 4 and 2. And if they needed me, if a phone rang at night, I was not so drunk that I couldn't pick it up. That today I'm able to articulate to my daughter that I love her, but I was also strong enough to throw her out of my house when it was time. And she might not have made it, but I had to love her so much that I had to do that. And I learned that here. And I learned that I couldn't sponsor her. I learned that I could go to another program for help with that. Called Alma. And I learned that I can continue to work with my sponsors. So I just want to say thank you to the people here that do all the service. I came here many years ago with my friend Kitty, who passed away. And to see the way it runs, the whole operation, you make everyone feel welcome. And I want to thank Ann and Phil for taking the ride with me. Phil was kind enough to drive. He doesn't have as much sobriety as his wife, but he'll celebrate 40 years of life.